filler de lampmen, I mean. She had been directed by Malinowski in a number of foreign films, Aunt Felicity went on, staring at her own hands as if they were those of a stranger. Most notably, of course, in Anna of the Steps, a role which led indirectly to her assignment and to her later downfall. Although she escaped with her life, she underwent a total breakdown, during which she developed an irrational horror of all Eastern Europeans. Which is why she insisted on always working with the same British cine crew, I said. Precisely. We had seen the re-released version of Anna of the Steps at the cinema in Hindley, where it was shown, with English subtitles, as Dressed for Dying. Although it had seemed at first to be just another of those endless yawners about the Russian Revolution, I soon found myself swept into the story, my eyes as dazzled by the stark black-and-white images as if I had stared too long at the sun. In fact, the unforgettable scene in which Phyllis Wyvern, as Anna, having put on her grandmother's Russian dress and heavy boots, carefully combed her hair and applied the scent and makeup brought to her from Paris by her lover, Marcel, lies down with her year-old baby in front of the army of snarling tractors, was still causing me occasional and inexplicable nightmares. "Miss Wyvern must have been a very brave woman," I said. Aunt Felicity returned to the window and looked out as if World War II was still raging somewhere in the fields to the east of Buckshaw.
"She was more than brave," she said. "She was British."
I let the silence linger until it was hanging by a thread, and then I said what I had come to say. "You must have heard everything that happened, being in the next room." Aunt Felicity looked suddenly drawn and old and helpless.
"I should have," she said. "God knows I should have."
"You mean you didn't?"
"I'm an old woman, Flavia. I suffer from the vicissitudes of age. I had a tot of rum at bedtime and slept with the pillow screwed into my good ear. That poor, dear, blasted soul ran cine films all night. I knew why, of course. But even sympathy has its limits."
"Does it?" I wondered. Or was Aunt Felicity simply deflecting further discussion? "So you heard nothing?" I said at last.
"I didn't say I'd heard nothing. I said I hadn't heard everything."
I walked across the room and stood beside her at the window. It had grown dark outside, and the snow was still falling as heavily as if the world were coming to a bitter end.
"I got up to use the WC. She was arguing with someone. The noise of the film, you see."
"Was it a man or a woman?"
"One couldn't be sure. Although they were keeping down the volume, it was evident that angry words were being exchanged, even with an ear to the wall. Oh, all right, don't look so shocked. I'll admit to clapping an ear to the wall. I couldn't make out what they were saying. I gave it up and went back to bed, determined to have a word with her in the morning."
"You hadn't spoken to her before that?"
"No," Aunt Felicity said. "There had been no opportunity. One had come across her unexpectedly in the corridor, but as I've told you, we were both of us too well trained in the art of seeming total strangers."
My mind was leapfrogging back and forth over the things that Aunt Felicity had told me. If, for instance, what she said was true, Phyllis Wyvern could not possibly have been arguing with someone when Auntie F got up to use the baffins, because she was already dead. I had heard the toilet flush, and I'd been in the death chamber moments later. Before that, someone had had enough time to strangle Phyllis Wyvern, dress her in different clothing, for whatever bizarre reason, and make their escape through one of three doors, the one to the corridor, the one that connected to Flo and Maeve's bedroom, or, and here I shot a nervous glance over my shoulder, the one that opened into the very room in which I was now standing. Aunt Felicity's bedroom, the very same Aunt Felicity who had just told me that she was capable of coming for me in the dark with a butcher knife. If what she said was true, if only half of what she hinted at were the ramblings of a woman who had grown suddenly old at the end of the war, She was capable of anything. Who knew what havoc old loyalties and older jealousies could play with two women who had once been friends? Or was it enemies? I needed time to think, time to get away, to collect my thoughts. "Thank you, Aunt Felicity," I said. "You must be very tired." I could always come back to her later to fill in the blanks. "You're such a thoughtful child," she said. I gave her a modest smile. The cupboard under the stairs was little more than a right-angled triangle equipped with a dangling light bulb. Here, stowed safely away from the eyes of the cine crew and their cameras, were the magazines that had been cleared away from the library in the drawing room. Back numbers of Country Life pressed down like geological strata upon old issues of the Illustrated London News. Heaped high with issues of Behind the Screen and Cinema Weekly, back numbers of Cinema World were piled in crooked stacks that must have dated back to the days of silent film. I stepped inside, closed the door behind me, and, taking down the first handful of cine magazines, began my search. I flipped through page after page of Cine Titbits and Silver Cinema, smiling at first at the antics of the so-called movie stars, most of whom I had never heard of. Parties, galas, premieres, benefit performances, smiling faces, toothy grins, top hats and sequin dresses, arms around shoulders in exotic motor cars. What vast amounts of time these people had spent having themselves photographed. It wasn't difficult to find Phyllis Wyvern. She was everywhere, spanning the years without apparently aging a day. Here she was, for instance, sitting, legs crossed, in a canvas chair with her name painted on the back, studying a script with a cardigan thrown over her shoulders and a look of intense concentration on her face. Here she was, dancing with a young airman in a dark nightclub that seemed to be located in a church crypt. And here she was again, on the set of Anna of the Steps, standing with another actress, their faces turned skyward, in front of one of the behemoth tractors as their makeup is retouched by a man in a mustache and a beret. Could it be? For a moment, I thought that the woman beside Phyllis Wyvern was Marion Trodd. A much younger Marion Trodd, to be sure, but still. In spite of my excitement, I was having difficulty in keeping my eyes focused on the page. The air in the cupboard was becoming stuffy, the bare bulb giving off a surprising amount of heat. That and the fact that I was bone-tired was making my head swim. How long had I been huddled in this cupboard? An hour? Perhaps two? It seemed like days. I rubbed my eyes with my fists, forcing myself to pay attention to the tiny type in which the caption was printed. Perhaps there was something, after all, in Father's insistence on having all of us outfitted with spectacles. I wore mine only when trying for sympathy, or when I needed to protect my eyes during a hazardous chemical experiment. I thought momentarily of running upstairs to get them, but decided against it. I shook my head and read the caption again. Phyllis Wyvern and Norma Durance freshen up between takes. Eyes front for the birdie, girls. What a disappointment. I must have been mistaken. I had thought for a moment that I was onto something, but the name Norma Durance meant nothing to me. Unless... Hadn't I seen that face a few issues back? Because the woman wasn't photographed with Phyllis Wyvern, I had paid her no attention. I went back a couple of issues. Yes! Here it was, in Silver Cinema. The actress is in a barnyard, throwing a handful of grain from her gathered-up skirt to a mob of frenzied chickens. Pretty Norma Durance ably undertakes the part of Dorita in The Little Red Hen. We hear she's not working for chicken feed. I held the magazine up to the light for a closer look. As I carefully studied the woman's features, the top edge of the cover pressed for a moment against the light bulb. In an instant, the tinder-dry paper had browned, then blackened, and before I could blink, burst into flame. It's wonderful how the mind works in such situations. I remembered distinctly that my first thought was, here's Flavia, her hands full of fire, in a cupboard jam-packed with combustibles. It was the kind of thing of which front-page stories in the Times are made.
Smouldering ashes are all that remain of historic country house, Buckshaw in ruins. And there would be a grisly photo, of course. I threw down the burning magazine and stamped on it again and again with my feet. But because of the waterproofing solution that Dogger applied so conscientiously to our footwear, a witch's brew containing both linseed and castor oils, as well as copal varnish, my shoes burst immediately into flames. I tore off my cardigan and dropped it onto my feet, stamping and bundling with my hands until the fire was out. By now my heart was pounding like a racing engine, and I found myself gasping for air. Fortunately, I had not burned myself. The fire had been quickly extinguished, with little trace remaining other than a few black ashes and some lingering smoke. I checked quickly to be sure that no sparks had lodged among the stacks of paper, then let myself out into the passageway, coughing as I went. I was pulling on my singed sweater and scraping the toes of my smoking shoes on the floorboards when the kitchen door opened and Dogger appeared. He looked at me closely without saying a word. "Unforeseen chemical reaction," I said. An air of weariness had fallen upon the foyer. No one paid the slightest attention to me as I passed through. Everywhere, the people of Bishop's Lacey sat staring blankly off into space, immersed in their own thoughts. In a corner, a card table with two chairs had been set up as an interrogation centre, and Sergeant Graves was murmuring away with Miss Cool, the village postmistress and confectioner. Dazed was the word for the rest of them. The earlier air of sharing in a jolly good adventure had worn off. Pretense had vanished, and everyone had sagged, exhausted at last into their real faces. Buckshaw had been made over into a bomb shelter. In the farthest corner from the police, the chauffeur, Anthony, sucked on a cigarette that he held concealed in a half-closed hand. He looked up and caught my eye, just as he had done when I dislodged the little avalanche of snow. What was he thinking? I sauntered casually off towards the west wing to have a look at the grandfather clock that stood in the corridor near Father's study. It must be getting late. The hands of the ancient timepiece stood at 10:17. Where could the day have gone? Even 24 hours seemed an eternity when one was cooped up indoors, and the days were the shortest of the year. But the death of Phyllis Wyvern, under the roofs of Buckshaw, had turned time topsy-turvy. The roofs of Buckshaw! My bucket of birdlime! Time was running out. If I was going to carry out my plans, I'd better get a bustle on. Christmas was nearly upon us. Father Christmas himself would soon be here. And so would the undertaker. Poor Phyllis Wyvern. I was going to miss her. Chapter 19. A quick jaunt to the Jakes was all I needed. With that attended to, I could get on with my plans. The closest convenience was at the top of the kitchen stairs, two doors along from Dogger's bedroom. When I reached it, I threw open the door and... my heart stopped. Naked from the waist up, Val Lampman was sitting on the toilet, clumsily trying to wrap one of his muscular arms with surgical lint. They were both horribly scratched and torn. He was as surprised as I was, and as he looked up at me, startled, his eyes became suddenly those of an injured hawk. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't know you were in here." I tried not to stare at the matching anchors tattooed on each of his forearms. Had he been a sailor? "What are you looking at?" he demanded in a harsh voice. "Nothing," I said. "May I help?" "No," he said, momentarily flustered. "Thank you. I was trying to help the lad shift the flat in one of the lorries, and it fell on me. My own fault, really." As if he expected me to believe him. Who in their right mind would be moving scenery, bare-armed and bare-chested, in the back of a freezing lorry? "I'm sorry," I said, taking the roll of lint from his hands and unreeling a fresh length. "You've cut your chest, too. Here, lean forward a bit and I'll wrap it round." My helpfulness allowed me to have a good look at his wounds, which were already lightly scabbed and red along the edges. Not fresh by any means,
but not old either. They had been inflicted, at a guess, 24 hours ago, and by fingernails, if I were any judge. Even though I had been cashiered from the Girl Guides for insubordination, I had not forgotten their many useful teachings, including the mnemonic PAD, pressure, antiseptic, dressing. Pad, 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 we used to shout, rolling about on the floor of the parish hall, mauling one another horribly, trussing our victims and ourselves like fat white mummies in the endless rolls of bandaging. Did you put iodine on these? I asked, knowing perfectly well that he hadn't. The telltale reddish-brown stains of that tincture were nowhere in evidence. Yes, he lied, and I noticed for the first time in the refuse container the blood-encrusted dressings he had just removed. It was very kind of you to help moving props, I said casually. I don't expect many directors would do that. It's not been easy with McNulty injured, he said. Still, one does what one can. Hmm, I said, trying to sound sympathetic, hoping he'd tell me more. But my mind was already racing through the corridors of Buckshaw, up the stairs, back to the blue bedroom, back to the body of Phyllis Wyvern, back to her fingernails, which had been remarkably clean. There had been no shreds of ripped flesh beneath them, no sign of blood, although her scarlet nail polish might have hidden the stains. I became suddenly aware that Val Lampman's eyes were fixed on mine as intently hypnotic as those of a cat on a cornered mouse. If he'd had a tail, it would have been swishing. He was reading my thoughts, I was quite sure of it. I tried not to think of the fact that the police might already have scraped out whatever bits of evidence were under Phyllis Wyvern's fingernails. Tried not to think that whoever had murdered her had taken the time to redress her, to paint her nails, and in doing so, to remove, before any of us got there, any matter that may have been lodged beneath them. I tried not to think, not to think, but it was no good. His eyes were boring into mine. Surely he had seen something. I'd better be getting along, I said suddenly. I promised the vicar I'd help with the... Although I could feel my heart pounding as it pumped blood into my face, I couldn't think of a single word to complete the lie. Things, I added weakly. I had already opened the door and put one foot in the corridor when he seized my arm. Wait, he said. From the corner of my eye I caught a glimpse of Dogger entering his room. It's all right, Dogger, I called out. I was just showing Mr. Lampman to the WC. Lampman let go his grip and I stepped back. He stood fixedly staring, the bandages on his chest rising and falling with every breath. I closed the door in his face. Dogger had already vanished. Good old Dogger. His sense of decorum kept him from intruding in all but the most extreme emergencies. Well, this hadn't been an emergency. Or had it? I'd talk to Dogger later, when I'd had time to think things through. It was still too soon. Had I unmasked Phyllis Wyvern's killer? Well, perhaps, but also perhaps not. It seemed quite unlikely that someone as placid-seeming as Val Lampman should strangle his own mother, change her clothing, and apply stage makeup in order to have her looking her best when her body was discovered. And those injuries on his arms and chest... Mightn't he simply have got into a tussle with Latshaw, his surly crew chief? There was no doubt about it. I needed to talk to Dogger. Yes, that was it. We'd sit down together later over a steaming kettle and a pair of teacups, and I'd run fleet-footed through my observations and deductions, and Dogger would marvel at my accomplishments. But until then, I had other things to do. It was with a cheery heart that I lugged my pot of birdlime up the narrow stairs. Good thing I'd thought to bring a clothes brush from the pantry to clear away the snow from the chimney pots, and a stiffish wallpaper brush from the little framing room in the picture gallery to slather the stuff on with. If the door had been a chore to open earlier, it was now a beast. I put my shoulder against it and shoved, and shoved again until at last the creaking snow yielded grudgingly, enough to allow me to squeeze out onto the roof. The wind struck me at once and I cringed against the cold. I trudged my way slowly across the snowy wastes to the west wing of the house, knee-deep in drifts. Father Christmas would come down the drawing-room chimney, as he always had. There was no point in wasting precious body heat and birdlime in painting the others. With the snow swept away from the collars of the three stacks, it was possible, although not by any means simple, to pull myself up, slipping and sliding, onto each of the towering brick turrets in turn, although I have to admit that I gave no more than a lick and a promise to the smaller pots that connected to the fireplaces in the upper bedrooms. Father Christmas wouldn't dare come down Father's chimney, and as for Harriet's, well, there was no longer any need, was there? Except for leaving myself a couple of narrow, glue-free paths in which to manoeuvre without becoming stuck myself, the application of the stuff was quite straightforward. When I was finished, I found myself frozen there for a moment on the roof, thinking, motionless in the bitter wind, a lightning-struck weather vane that points forever in the wrong direction. And then, just as quickly, my spirits were restored. Wasn't I, after all, within hours of being able to write conclusion to my grand experiment? As I fought my way back across the snowy wastes, I whistled a few bars of The Holly and the Ivy in sly reference to the sticky mess I had just applied to the chimneys of Buckshaw. I even broke into song. The rising of the sun and the running of the deer. It was time to turn my attention to the rocket of honour. What are you doing? Feely demanded as I descended the last few steps into my laboratory. Her fists were clenched and her eyes, as they always are when she's angry, were several shades lighter than their normal blue. Who let you in? I asked. You're not allowed in this room without written permission from me. Oh, take your written permission and stick it up the flue. Feely could be remarkably coarse when she felt like it. Still, stick and flue were uncannily descriptive of what I'd just done on the roof. I'd better be careful, I thought. Perhaps Feely, like Val Lampman, had found a way of peering into my mind. Father sent me to fetch you, she said. He wants everyone gathered in the foyer at once. He has something to say, and so does Val Lampman. She turned and strode off towards the door. Feely, I said. She stopped and, without looking at me, turned halfway round. Well? Daph and I made a Christmas truce. I thought perhaps. Truces expire after 5 minutes, come hell or high water, as you jolly well know. There's no such thing as a Christmas truce. Don't try to suck me into any of your sordid little schemes. I could feel my eyes swelling as if they were about to burst. Why do you hate me? I asked suddenly. Is it because I'm more like Harriet than you are? If the room had been cold before, it was now a glacial ice cave. Hate you, Flavia? She said, her voice trembling. Do you really believe I hate you? Oh, how I wish I did. It would make things so much easier. And with that, she was gone.
I'm sorry we've all of us been trapped, as it were, Father was saying, even though we've been trapped together.
What the dickens did he mean? Was he apologizing for the weather?
Despite their, polar expedition, the vicar and Mrs. Richardson have done yeoman work in keeping the little ones entertained.
Good Lord, was Father making a joke?
It was unheard of.
Had the stress of the season and the arrival of the movie makers finally cracked his brain? Had he forgotten that Phyllis Wyvern was lying? No, not lying, but sitting dead upstairs. His words were greeted with a polite rustle of laughter from the people of Bishop's Lacey, who sat rumpled but attentive in their chairs. Clustered in one corner, the cine crew whispered together uneasily, their faces like masks.
I am assured,
Father was saying, with a glance at Mrs. Mullet, who stood beaming at the entrance of the kitchen passageway,
that we shall be able to muster up sufficient jam and fresh baked bread to last until we are released from our captivity.
At the word captivity, Dogger sprang to mind. Where was he? I swiveled round and spotted him at once. He was standing well off to one side, his dark suit making him nearly invisible against the stained wood panelling. His eyes were black pits. I squirmed in my chair, hunched and unhunched my shoulders as if to relieve stiffness, and standing up, stretched extravagantly. I sauntered casually over to the wall and leaned against it.
Dogger, I whispered excitedly. They dressed her for dying.
Dogger's head turned slowly towards me, his eyes sweeping round the vast room, illuminating as they came until, as they reached mine, they were as the beam of a lighthouse fixed on a rock in the sea.
I believe you're right, Miss Flavia, he said.
With Dogger, there was no need to prattle on. The look that went between us was beyond words. We were riding the same train of thought and, aside from the unfortunate death of Phyllis Wyvern, of course, all was well with the world. Dogger had obviously noticed, as I had, that... But there was no time to think. I had missed Father's concluding remarks. Val Lampman had now taken the spotlight, a tragic figure who was hanging on to a lighting fixture with the most awful white knuckles, as if to keep from crumbling to the floor.
This terrible event, he was saying in an unsteady voice. It would be unthinkable to go on without Miss Wyvern, and I have therefore reluctantly made the decision to shut down production at once and return to London as soon as we are able.
A collective sigh went up from the corner in which the cine crew was gathered, and I saw Marion Trod lean forward and whisper something to Bun Keats.
Because we are unable to communicate with the studio, Val Lampman went on, putting two fingers to his temple as if receiving a message from the planet Mars, I'm sure you will appreciate that this decision must needs be mine alone. I'll see that specific instructions are handed out in the morning. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, I suggest that we spend whatever is left of this rather sad Christmas Eve remembering Miss Wyvern and what she has meant to each and every one of us.
It was not Phyllis Wyvern I thought of, though, but Feely. With filming shut down, her chance of stardom was over. Ages from now, sometime in the misty future, historians sifting through the vaults of Ilium Films would come across a spool of film with images of a letter being placed carefully, again and again, upon a tabletop. What would they make of it, I wondered. It was pleasant, in a complicated way, to think that those out-of-focus hands with their long, perfect fingers, would be those of my sister. Feely would be all that remained of the cry of the raven, the film that died before it was born. I came back to reality with a start. Father was summoning Dogger with a single raised eyebrow, and I took the opportunity to escape up the stairs. I had much to do, and there was little time left. And yet there was. When I got to my bedroom, I saw that it was not yet 11 o'clock. I had always been told by Mrs. Mullet that Father Christmas did not come either until after midnight or until everyone in the household was asleep. I've forgotten the exact formula. One way or another, it was far too early to check my traps. With half the population of Bishop's Lacey wandering about at large in the house, the old gentleman would hardly risk coming down the drawing-room chimney. And then this thought came to mind. How could Father Christmas climb down and back up so many million chimneys without getting his costume dirty? Why had there never been, on Christmas morning, a filthy black trail on the carpet? I knew perfectly well from my own experiments that the carbonic products of combustion were messy enough even in the small quantities in which they were encountered in the laboratory. But to think of a full-grown man descending a chimney encrusted with decades of soot while wearing an outfit that was little better than an oversized pipe cleaner was beyond belief. Why hadn't I thought of this before? Why had such an obviously scientific proof never occurred to me? Unless there was some invisible elf who followed Father Christmas around with a broom and a dustpan, or a supernatural hoover, things were looking grim indeed. Outside, a rising wind buffeted at the house, rattling the window panes in their ancient frames. Inside, the temperature had fallen to that of a penguin's feet, and I shivered in spite of myself. I would tuck up in bed with my notebook and a pencil. Until it was time to venture out onto the roof, I would turn my attention to murder. I wrote at the top of a fresh page, "Who killed Phyllis Wyvern?" and drew a line under it. Suspects, alphabetically. Anthony, the chauffeur. I don't know his surname. A lurking sort of person with a hangdog expression who seems always to be watching me. PW seemed cold towards him, but perhaps this is the way of all film stars to their drivers. Is he resentful? Seemed vaguely familiar when he appeared on our doorstep. Eastern European? Or was it just his uniform? Surely not. Aunt F said PW had an irrational horror of Eastern Europeans and insisted upon always working with the same British film crew. Had Anthony, perhaps, appeared in one of her pictures? Or in a magazine photo? Look into, perhaps even ask him outright. Crawford Gill. PW humiliated him in front of the entire village by slapping his face. Although gentle as a lamb nowadays, it's important to remember that as a commando, Gill was trained to kill in silence, by strangulation with a bit of piano wire. Duncan Desmond. No obvious motive other than that PW overshadows him. He's acted with her for years on stage and in film. Rivalry? Jealousy? Something deeper? Further inquiry needed. Keats Bunn. PW treats her like dog dirt on the sole of a dancing slipper. Although she should be filled with resentment, she seems not to be. Are there people who thrive on abuse? Or is there fire beneath the ashes? Must ask Dogger about this. Lampman, Val, Valdemar. PW's son. Hard to believe, but Aunt Felicity claims it's so. PW threatened to tell DD about Val's interesting adventure in Buckinghamshire. Obvious tension between them, e.g. the benefit performance of Romeo and Juliet. Does he stand to inherit his mother's estate? Did she have bags and bags of money? How can I find that out? And what about his horribly scratched forearms? The wounds didn't seem fresh. Another point to talk over with Dogger in the morning. Latshaw, Ben. Seems something of a troublemaker. But what would he gain by bringing the film's production to a halt? He had been promoted due to Patrick McNulty's injury. Could he have been hired by someone at Ilium Films to do in PW far from the studio? Mere speculation on my part. Trod, Marion. The horn-rimmed mystery. Hangs round in silence like the smell of a clogged drain. She bears a strong resemblance to the actress Norma Durance. But those were old photos. Should have asked Aunt Felicity about her. N.B. Do later. I scratched my head with the pencil as I reviewed my notes. I could see at once that they were far from satisfactory. In most criminal investigations, both on the wireless and in my own experience, there are always more suspects than you can shake a stick at. But in this case, the field seemed sparse indeed. While there had been no shortage of grudges against Phyllis Wyvern, there had been no outright hatred. Nothing that would even begin to explain her brutal strangling or the bow of motion picture film tied almost gaily round her neck. In fact, I could still see it, that band of black celluloid at her throat, each of its frames bearing a still image of the actress herself in her peasant blouse, her defiant face shining like the sun against a dramatically darkened sky. How could I forget it when I had seen it so often in my dreams? It was from that shocking final scene of Anna of the Steps, alias Dressed for Dying, in which Phyllis Wyvern, as the doomed Anna Sherestakova, lays herself down in front of the advancing tractors. In my tired mind, I fancied I could hear the sound of their snarling engines, but it was only the wind as it howled and battered at the house. Wind, tractors, Dieter, Feely. When my eyes snapped open, it was 8 minutes past midnight. From somewhere in the house came the sound of singing. Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. I could see in my mind the reverently upturned faces of the villagers. I knew instantly that, in spite of everything that had happened, the vicar had decided to observe Christmas. He had asked the men of the village to move our old Broadwood grand piano from the drawing room into the foyer, and Feely was now at the keyboard. I knew it was Feely and not Max Brock, because of the hesitating little sob she was able to extract from the instrument as the melody flew up and then began to fall. Because Phyllis Wyvern's remains were still present in the house, the vicar was allowing only the more subdued carols to be sung. I leapt out of bed and pulled on a pair of the long, mud-coloured cotton stockings that Father insisted I wear outdoors in winter. Although I hated the scraggly things with a passion, I knew how cold it would be on the roof. That done, I grabbed the powerful torch I had pinched from the pantry and passed as silently as I could into my laboratory, where I shoved a flint igniter into the pocket of my cardigan. I gently took up the plump rocket of honour, cradling it in my arms for a couple of moments and smiling down upon it as lovingly as in a nativity scene. Then I made for the narrow staircase. Chapter 20. The roof was a howling wilderness. A biting wind blew stinging gusts of snow from peak to peak, blasting my face with particles as hard as frozen sand. The weather had worsened since last I had been up here, and it was clear that the storm was far from over. Now came the real work. Trip after trip I made, back and forth, up and down the stairs between roof and laboratory, lugging pot after pot until at last my fireworks were ranged in rings round the chimney stacks, like so many unlit candles on a tiered cake. Although it was difficult to see in the darkness, I was reluctant to switch on the torch until it became absolutely necessary. No need to attract unwanted attention from the ground, I thought, by creating a wandering will-o'-the-wisp among the dark chimney pots, which now loomed above me, tall, ominous shadows against the snowy sky. The dark clouds, sagging above my head like half-deflated blimps, were almost low enough to reach up and touch. I had now completed my last trip, and Phyllis Wyvern's rocket of honour was cradled heavily in my arms. I could not possibly lug it with me round acres of roof while I completed my preparations, nor could I dump it out here in the open, where it would quickly become wet and useless. No, I would set the thing up on the east side of one of the chimneys, where it would be sheltered from the stormy blast, ready to launch when the time came. I trudged my way through what seemed like miles of knee-deep snow and gave a gasp of relief when I finally spotted my destination, the towering chimney pots of Buckshaw's West Wing. With surprisingly little trouble, I set up the rocket in the midst of my flowerpot fireworks by folding down the legs of the wire tripod I had improvised from a couple of Feely's clothes hangers. Just one flick of the igniter and whoosh! Up it would climb into the night sky like a blazing comet, before exploding with a boom that would awaken St. Tancred himself, who had lain sleeping under the altar of the village church for more than 500 years. In fact, I had added an extra cup of gunpowder to the rocket's inner chamber to assure that the dozing Saint T would not be left out of the festivities. The rocket of honour, of course, would be the finale to my show of chemical pyrotechnics. First would come the golden rains and the opening buds of red fire, giving way gradually to the bangs and booms of the Bengali bombards. I hugged myself, partly in glee and partly from the cold. I would begin with the Royal Salute, a genteel but impressive aerial display whose recipe I had found in one of Uncle Tar's notebooks. It had been formulated originally by the famous Ruggieri brothers for King George II in 1749 and designed to accompany the music that Mr. Handel had composed especially for the Royal Fireworks display. Since the large wooden building constructed to house the king's musicians had been set ablaze by the fireworks and gone up in flames, and the sheer number of spectators had caused one of the spans of London Bridge to collapse under their weight into the River Thames, that first performance had not been entirely successful. Who is to say? My recreation of a few of those famous explosions might make up, if only a little, for what must have been at the time something of a national embarrassment. Let the show begin! I swept away the snow from my waterproof flower pots and reached into my pocket for the igniter. If the wind let up even for a few seconds, one good spark would be all that was needed. A single spark to set off a display of fire they would still be talking about when I was an old lady cackling over my chemical cauldrons. I stepped back for one last look at my lovingly crafted explosives. Perhaps it was because my eyes had been squeezed half shut against the blowing snow that I had not immediately noticed the second set of footprints stretching back towards the door. "Father Christmas," I thought at once. "He's parked his sleigh, walked across the roof, and gone into the house by the same door I've just come out." But why? Why wouldn't he have climbed immediately down the chimney, as he had been doing for hundreds of years? Of course, it was suddenly as plain as a pikestaff. Father Christmas was supernatural, wasn't he? He'd have known about my glue and steered clear of it. Did supernatural beings even leave traces in the snow? Why hadn't I thought of this stupidly simple point sooner and saved myself all the trouble? But wait. Hadn't I been up here myself earlier to set up my pots of fireworks? Of course. What a little fool you are, Flavia. I was looking at my own footprints. And yet, almost before that thought came to mind, I knew it could not possibly be true. It had been hours since I was last on the roof. With the blowing wind and the drifting snow, my own earlier footprints would surely have been filled in within minutes. Even my fresh-made prints were already losing their sharply defined edges. A couple of leaps brought me to the trail of tracks, and I could see at a glance, close up, that they led away from the door, not towards it. Someone, besides Flavia and Father Christmas, had been up here on the roof. And quite recently, if I was not mistaken. Furthermore, if I had read the signs correctly, they were still up here, hiding somewhere in the snowy wastes. "Run for it, Flavia," the ancient instinctive part of my brain was shrieking. And yet I was still hovering, frozen by the moment, reluctant to move even an inch, when a dark figure stepped silently out from behind the chimney pot of Harriet's boudoir. It was dressed in a long, old-fashioned leather aviator's coat that reached halfway down its riding boots, the high collar turned up above the ears. Its eyes were covered with the small, round, green lenses of an ancient leather helmet of the sort Harriet had worn in her flying days, and its hands gloved in long, stiff leather gauntlets. My first thought, of course, was that this spectre was my mother. And my blood froze. Although I had longed all of my life to be reunited with Harriet, I did not want it to be like this. Not masked, not on a windswept roof. I'm afraid I whimpered. "Who are you?" I managed. "Your past," I thought the figure whispered. Or was it just the wind? "Who are you?" I demanded again. The figure took a menacing step towards me. Then suddenly, somewhere inside my head, a voice was speaking as calmly as the BBC wireless announcer reading out the shipping forecasts for Rockall, the Shetlands, and the Orkneys. "Keep your head," it was saying. "You know this person. You simply haven't realized it yet." And it was true. although I had all the information I needed, I hadn't put together all of the pieces. This spectre was really no more than someone who had dressed themselves up from the film studio's wardrobe, someone who did not want to be recognized.
"It's no good, Mr. Lampman," I said, standing my ground. "I know you murdered your mother."
Somehow, it didn't seem right to call him Val.
"You and your accomplice did her in and rigged her up in the costume she wore and dressed for dying, the role you had promised to your, what do you call it, your mistress."
It was almost comforting to hear the words of that old formula coming out of my mouth. The final exchange between a cold-blooded killer and the investigator who had cracked the case. It had taken a great deal of poring over the pages of Cinema Secrets and Silver Screen to dig out that final incriminating tidbit. I was proud of myself. But not for long. The figure made a sudden lunge, taking me by surprise, almost knocking me backwards into a snowdrift. Only by windmilling my arms and making a blind and off-balance leap backwards was I able to stay on my feet. With my attacker blocking the way to the staircase, there was no point in making a dash for it. Better to find safety in height, like a cat. I scrambled, slipping and sliding up onto one of the chimney collars, one that I hadn't slathered with glue. From up here, I could hold on with one arm while kicking the killer in the face, should the need arise. It didn't take long. With a hiss like an infuriated snake, my attacker pulled from one of its large coat pockets a stick, which I believed is called by the police a truncheon or a billy club, and brought the thing crashing down just inches from my feet. Whack, it went, and whack again, the blows raining down on the brick ledge of the chimney pot with a series of sharp, sickening sounds like bones being broken. I had to leap like a Highland dancer to keep my toes from being pulverized. Behind me, I remembered, on the drawing room chimney were the fuses for the fireworks, perhaps no more than 10 yards away. If only I could reach them, touch the striker to the fuse, summon help, the rest of it would be in the hands of fate. But now the gauntlets were grabbing at my ankles, and I was kicking back at them for all I was worth. This time I was rewarded with the sound and the feel of shoe leather on skull, and the figure reeled back with a hoarse cry of pain, clutching at its face. Taking advantage of the moment, I edged my way round to the far side of the chimney. From there, I could leap down unseen, I hoped, onto the roof. I had to risk it. There was no other choice. I landed more lightly than expected and was already halfway to the drawing-room chimney when my attacker spotted me and, with a cry of rage, came charging across the roof, its boots throwing up clods of snow as it came. Out of breath, I threw myself at the chimney, this one larger than the first, and pulled myself up to safety, my hand already digging into my pocket for the igniter. The fuses were now just below me at shoe level. With any luck, just one click would do the trick. I ducked down and squeezed the spring handle. Click. And nothing more. Too late now, my attacker was already clawing at the ledge like a maddened animal, preparing to haul itself up beside me. If that happened, I was finished. I swung at its goggled face with the torch and missed. The torch slipped out of my hand and fell, as if in slow motion, tumbling end over end down onto the roof, where it lay half buried in a snowdrift, shooting a crazily angled beam up into my attacker's eyes, half blinding it. I didn't waste a single instant. I ducked down and flicked the igniter again. Click, 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 click. Infuriating! I should have coated the fuses with candle wax, but one can't think of everything. Obviously, they had become damp. The clutching gloves were coming uncomfortably closer. It was only a matter of time before they managed to seize my ankle and drag me down onto the roof. With that disturbing thought in mind, I shimmied a little higher up the clay chimney pot, again working my way, as I climbed, fully round to the east side of the structure. On the roof, my attacker followed me around, perhaps half expecting me to slip and fall. high above its horribly helmeted head, my every breath visible on the cold air, I clung like a limpet to the upper section of the chimney. A moment passed, and then another. I became aware of a growing warmness. Had the wind let up, or had summer suddenly come? Perhaps I was running a fever. I thought of the thousand warnings of Mrs. Mullet. Sudden chills fill the ills, she never tired of telling me. The ills meaning them little ills in the churchyard, of course. Dress up warm, dear, if you want to get your 100 years birthday letter from the king. I clutched my cardigan closed beneath my chin. Below me, the figure had turned abruptly and was walking off towards the battlements of the west wing. It seemed like a peculiar thing to do, but almost instantly, I saw the reason. At a point on the roof, directly above the drawing room, the aerial for our wireless was stretched between a pair of slender, vertical bamboo poles. Seizing the closest pole with its gauntlet, my attacker put a boot against the socketed base and gave a sharp tug. Perhaps more than anything because of the cold, the bamboo snapped off as easily as if it had been a matchstick. It was now attached only to the copper wire. A quick twist of the wrist and that too had broken away, leaving my assailant holding a bamboo pole with two wickedly jagged ends. From one of these dangled a white china insulator that had somehow remained attached by a twist of wire. Again, I found myself staring straight down into the upturned face of my assailant. If only I could reach out and rip the goggles from that face. But I couldn't. Those mad eyes stared up at me through the green goggles in cold, dead hatred, and a shiver shook my frame, a kind of shiver I had never known before. Those eyes, I realized, with a sudden sickening jolt, were not ringed by their usual horn-rimmed glasses. My attacker was not Val Lampman. "Marion Trott is killing me," I heard my own voice screaming, and the realization must have surprised her as much as it surprised me. It might have been less frightening if she'd said something, but she didn't. She stood there in the silence of the drifting snow, still glaring up at me with that look of quite impersonal hatred. And then, as if taking a bow at the end of a play, she lifted the goggles and slowly removed the flyer's helmet. "It was you," I gasped. "You and Val Lampman." She made a little hiss of contempt, rather like a snake. Without a word, she extended the pole and, placing it in the middle of my chest, gave a vicious shove. I let out a cry of pain, but somehow managed to twist my body in the direction of the thrust. At the same time, I dragged myself a little higher. But I might as well have saved the effort. The end of the stick with its dangling insulator was now hovering directly in front of my face. I simply couldn't allow her to poke me in the eyes or to catch the corner of my mouth with the wire like a hooked fish. Almost without thinking, I seized the end of the pole and slammed it hard against the chimney. At the shock, Marion let go of the handle, and the pole fell away silently into the snow. Now, suddenly infuriated, as if wanting to tear me apart personally with her bare hands, she launched herself directly at me, this time managing to get a firm grip on the bricks of the ledge. She had already pulled herself halfway up when she seemed to lurch, then suddenly stall in mid-air, like a partridge hit on the wing. A muffled curse came to my ears. "The bird lime! The bird lime! Oh, joy! The bird lime!" I had given the downwind ledge of the drawing-room chimney-pot an extra slathering of the stuff on the theory that Father Christmas would choose the sheltered side to climb out of his sleigh. Marion Trott was tugging away fiercely, trying to rip her hands free of the stuck gloves, but the more she struggled, the more she became entangled with her riding boots and long coat. I had wondered, idly, while preparing the stuff, if my glue would be weakened by the cold, but it was obvious that it had not. If anything, it had become stronger and stickier, and it was becoming more evident by the minute that only by undressing completely could Marion hope to escape. I seized the moment and bent to the fuse again. Click, click, click.
curses and counter-curses, the blasted thing refused to ignite.
In the ghastly silence that followed, as Marion Trod tried in vain to free herself, her movements becoming ever more restricted, the sound of singing came floating to my ears.
The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight.
I don't know why, but the words bit at my bones.
Dogger! I shouted, my voice hoarse and broken in the cold air. Dogger! Help me!
But I knew in my heart that with everyone singing about Bethlehem, they couldn't possibly have heard me. Besides, it was too far from the roof.